I'd like to welcome Michelle Briegel to the podcast today. I know Michelle as a professor in the Child and Youth Care Counseling Program at Mount Royal University. And so welcome, Michelle.
Thank you very much for having me, Kathy.
Thank you. I wonder if for our listeners, if you could share a little bit about your current professional role and some of the educational and background experiences that have brought you to where your career is now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I should probably just start with my education, actually. And my first education was in criminology. I did a diploma in criminology in the corrections sector of criminology with a specific focus of young offenders, because my interest was always in young people, teenagers who were having challenges and having difficulties. And I think that stems from my high school experiences with having a few challenges myself and knowing people that had challenges and knowing that, you know, there was some help out there and some programs, but not that many. And they certainly weren't reaching the teens. So I had an interest in that. Now, I didn't go into school right out of high school. I actually worked for a number of years in other sectors and got a bit of a taste for what I didn't want. And that's what helped me to make the decision to go to college to pursue this career that I was striving for. While I was in college, I actually met a professor who was a mentor of mine, and he owned a group home. And he asked me at the time if I was interested in doing some part-time work at this group home. And of course, you know, starving student, I was absolutely interested. And so I started to work at this group home that he had, which was a group home in the community. It's called a long-term group home. It housed 6 beds for youth who were in the child welfare system. And we're in the system for a long time. So it was called a long-term group home. And we would have kids for, well, anywhere from a short period of time, because we were able to find a different circumstance for them, foster home or return them home or something like that. But we would have kids for 3 to 4 years sometimes in that setting. And that's where I realized that my calling was really in child and youth care. Which, when I was seeking my education in the first place, I didn't know that child and youth care was even a thing of its own. So I got into the profession of child and youth care that way. And that's where I stayed. So I say that my roots are in residential services, because that's where I started. And that's where I always stayed throughout my majority of my career, somehow connected with residential services. Now, we've actually changed the term of residential services to group home, group care, congregate living, those types of terms, because the term residential has a negative connotation, as most of us know in Canada. And so we have started to move away from that terminology. But I ended up, after I graduated from my diploma, I ended up actually being the director of that program, which was kind of like the manager of the program. And I did that for many years until a degree was offered at Mount Royal University in Justice Studies. And it was one of the first applied degrees ever offered at Mount Royal University. Sorry, it was Mount Royal College still at the time. And I did that because I was able to continue working full-time in my job and use my job as my practical experience when I was doing my degree. So I did a Bachelor of Applied Justice Studies, again, specializing or focusing more on youth justice and youth issues. Then from there, I moved into a higher managing role, because we merged that group home with another larger agency in the city. And I took a bigger management role, kind of up in the higher rungs of the middle management area of the agency. And I managed a number of group care programs, including one of the open custody youth justice facilities in the province. And that's actually where my justice background and my child welfare background tied together so nicely. I was able to create and develop a really unique program there for girls, adolescent girls, that focused on their multifaceted needs and a holistic service approach that involved justice and psychological services, education, addiction services. So we were able to create a program that had everything right on site. And then I started teaching part-time at Mount Royal. And I was asked to teach in the Child and Youth Care Diploma Program of Mount Royal College. One of the professors there knew me through the group home sector and knew that I had experience in youth justice as well as the child welfare system, and thought that that would be a really good tie in for a policy class that we have in our program or had in our diploma program. And that's how I started at Mount Royal, which was really fantastic for me because I had a complete turnaround from being a student there to teaching there, which I was very, very proud of, and I still am today. And so I taught for 12 years part-time, contract faculty at Mount Royal, while maintaining management positions with a variety of different agencies and variety of different programs. And then I finally was able to get a tenure track position when one opened up. And I was able to kind of flip that and work full-time in child and youth care education and part-time in the field. So what I do part-time in the field now is I'm very involved with the movement towards regulating child and youth care counselors, practitioners in the province of Alberta, as well as I do groups with adolescent girls using an expressive arts-based group programming model. So that's a little bit of what my career is and where and how I got to what I do today.
Thanks. With your prior experience and knowledge as a child and youth care practitioner and now professor, how has that intertwined with your personal life, and what challenges have you faced with your teenager prior to COVID?
Great question. So I was really lucky in that I worked with so many teenagers by the time I had my own. And I went into parenting with a belief that nothing was going to scare me and nothing was going to surprise me because I had seen so much. Which there's some truth to that, but it was also a little naive thinking because, boy, do things are different when you're a parent, for sure, and you react differently than you think you're going to. So I was very lucky in that I had a lot of knowledge about the development of an adolescent, adolescent brain development, experiences with behaviors and different things. I had a really good idea of what was going on in drug culture in the city. For some time I worked with a program that is under the Protection of Sexually Exploited Children's Act. And so I had a good idea of what was happening with, you know, sexual exploitation and areas like that. So I felt well prepared that, you know, all of the big ugly stuff I had good knowledge of, and how to avoid it and how to prepare my daughter for what was out there. What I didn't realize is that what was going to come at us was going to be more of a mental health issue than anything else. And although I was knowledgeable about things in that area, I wasn't prepared for the impact that it was going to have on me as a parent, on our family, and on my teenage child. Mm-hmm. So what I can tell you is that pre-COVID, at around, about starting at around 6 years old, where we started to see anxiety symptoms, starting with my daughter, and some motor tics and fears that were coming up. And, you know, her father actually has obsessive compulsive disorder. So I was aware of what that looked like and was concerned that maybe that's what was going on for her. And we certainly looked into it right away, but we were assured that, no, that wasn't the case. It's very common for young children to have tics, nervous tics, and that they outgrow it. And so we just trusted that that's what was going to happen. Unfortunately, she didn't outgrow it. Her tics became worse over time. Her anxiety became worse over time, and her fears became worse. And so we definitely saw that more obsessive, compulsive traits and characteristics starting to grow as she grew older. At about 13 years old, though, she had a medical scare where she was having some trouble seeing, and we had her at the eye doctor. We were working with trying to figure out what was going on, and in very, very quick order, they realized that she had hydrocephalus, which is known as water on the brain. It's actually spinal fluid in the brain, which should be there. It just normally cycles through. But where it would normally drain was plugged for her. It was there was like something that was not allowing it to drain like it should. So she had to have emergency neurosurgery. And that really changed our lives in a big way. We post-surgery really started to see her fears for her own health and safety go up, which makes sense. It was emergent, or they told her that she was going to die if she didn't do this. So it was pretty bad. So that really moved her into a place of OCD, you know, starting to flare up in a bigger way. A year after that, she developed an eating disorder, restrictive anorexia, which absolutely relates to the anxiety, to the fears that she had in place, also to some personality pieces around perfectionism and of course, the anxiety. There were some other factors that helped the eating disorder, the anorexia, get triggered, environmental factors that happened at school and with her social group, and this desire to have model bodies and be a certain weight and see what they mimic, what they were seeing on social media and that sort of thing. So that that triggered what ended up developing into a deadly eating disorder, where she was hospitalized and she was having heart problems because of it very, very quickly. So we had both of those things on board already before COVID. And although we had done already a few years of treatment and she was in a much better place, but when COVID hit, we definitely saw a change. Things spiraled down the rabbit hole quick, fast, and dangerously.
Can you share some of what happened with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the beginning of COVID, she got really sick, and she ended up in the hospital with something going on with her lung. And, of course, we were concerned that maybe it was COVID. We did a test. She might have been one of the first, actually, in our small town to get tested for COVID. And it came back negative. But this pain, she had pain in her chest. And It was worsening really quickly. And so we were kind of in and out of hospital, had a diagnosis of pleurisy and then pneumonia, but then ended up back and in the children's hospital, the Alberta Children's Hospital, where they told us that they were concerned that she might have lung cancer, which of course absolutely devastated all of us, but really created another medical emergent trauma situation for her. We did find out after they did a lung biopsy that it wasn't lung cancer. It was a pneumonia that just reacted so bizarrely in her body, something that they typically don't see. And her body had formed a protective barrier around the infection, which gave a rigid edge appearance to it, which is why they thought it was lung cancer when they were looking at the images. So she was hospitalized for, 2 weeks on heavy, heavy doses of antibiotics to treat this because it was so severe. And again, there were conversations about, could this be COVID? Could it be could we have had a false negative result on the first test? Should we bother testing now? Should we not? Could it be tuberculosis? Could it be something else? So she was in the infectious disease care, under the care of the infectious disease team, and was in a confinement room where she was quarantined, and it was very scary. It was very scary. So once we got home from there, her fear and her amygdala was on overdrive. Like, she was in constant panic, fight, flight mode, and things just really, really got bad. So her eating disorder was triggered again. Her OCD was triggered immensely. So for the past year, we've had challenges with getting her to eat again properly and with the amount of nutrients that she needs, because you can imagine she was so sick in the hospital and on so many medications that she wasn't able to eat very much. She was very nauseous. She dropped a lot of weight, and the more weight she dropped, the less nourished her brain became, and the less nourished her brain was, the more OCD and the more eating disorder had room to grow. So we watched that happening. As she's watching the news and seeing, you know, case counts go up and death counts go up and lockdown measures going into place and stay-at-home orders and that sort of thing, her brain immediately went to everything is ending. We are in crisis. We are in danger. We are in imminent, immediate danger. This is bad. We're going to die. And her OCD thinking got really locked into that and locked into that harm was going to come to her family members. And if she didn't start to do things a certain way or eat a certain way or not eat, or, OCD compulsions come up in some very bizarre ways sometimes. But they were in her thinking was that if she didn't do these things, that her loved ones were going to get COVID and die. So you can imagine how, whether it be the radio being on, the TV being on, you can't get away from it, right? And you can't get out to do normal things that you would normally do as a family or as a teenager, being out with friends, being at school, all of these things that were happening. She was graduating from grade 12 at the time. Her grad was canceled. We just bought this $800 beautiful gown that's, you know, hanging in the closet still. Everything just slammed closed, and panic was set off. And we have been struggling and battling with that panic now to try and normalize it, normalize life and bring that panic down to a base level. Unfortunately, with teenage brains, they have a really hard time understanding that that panic doesn't have to set in and doesn't have to stay in a panic place, and that what the future might look like, because their brains aren't really wired yet to see what the future or predict what the future might be, and they don't have enough life experience to know that, oh, there's been illnesses in the past, and we can look to the past and say, yeah, unfortunately, there are going to be deaths, yes, and there's going to be some really difficult things that happen. But if we look to the past, we can say over a certain period of time that the pandemic stays in place, it will come to an end.
Right.
Her brain, and I think many other young people's brains, were in this, get locked into this place of, this is never going to end. And there's why life isn't worth living. Everything is hopeless now and worthless, and there's no hope for the future.
Right. Which is what we're seeing with a lot of youth.
That's it.
Is that those kinds of attitudes?
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Are there any other things about brain development and how the COVID experience, it's the shutdown experiences,
yes,
particularly for adolescents, and as you say, losing out on those once in a lifetime experiences, mm-hmm, and the whole socialization piece. Mm-hmm. What can you share about that?
Yeah, definitely. I've got a few thoughts. So Dr. Dan Siegel has a great book called Brainstorm, and it's about the adolescent brain and the development of the adolescent brain and why teenagers are the way that they are. Mm-hmm. I definitely would recommend it as a read or an ebook. Really, really good, important information in there that I think helps parents understand what's happening in their teenager, because regardless of a pandemic, teenagers are bizarre creatures to us, right? they seem to totally lose themselves at about 11, 12 years old, and we wonder if they're ever going to come back. Mm-hmm. So, and it's all because their brain starts to undergo remodeling, which what's happening is that the brain has been developed for some time already, but in that adolescent stage starts to develop the prefrontal cortex, which wasn't there before. And so the whole brain goes into a remodeling, under construction type of zone. And what happens is that the prefrontal cortex is growing and it needs to communicate with the rest of the brain. So the rest of the brain, which has been communicating in one way for the past number of years, needs to learn how to communicate with this new piece of the brain. So Dr. Siegel talks about it in a way of almost like you're remodeling a house, where when you're remodeling, you may be without plumbing for a little while, or you might be without electricity for a little while. And so that's what's happening in the brain. So that's why you can see with your adolescent that there's times you're like, what are you thinking? Like, where's your head? Are you even thinking about that? And they're not. Right? They're absolutely not. And so they can look really crazy in teens.
Well, that made me think of, we say, where's your brain? Where's your prefrontal cortex?
Yes, where's your prefrontal cortex? Well, it's under development. And the prefrontal cortex is what is responsible for balancing emotional reactions, for planning for the future, and for insight and empathy. So if you think about the teenage brain, think about teenagers that you know. There might be times where, they're actually acting very mature. They're empathizing well. They're able to plan for the future a bit. And then 2 days later, it's like you have a 4-year-old in the house again. and they can't control their emotions. They don't have any insight into their own behavior. So they're all over the place and it's totally normal. You can think of it like their emotions while this is happening are like nerves that are completely raw and exposed. And then those emotions have a fast track to the amygdala. The amygdala triggers our fight, flight, freeze response. So that's, again, why teenagers will be really quick to argue or will completely shut down sometimes. You can almost see like the gates closing in their eyes, like they're just not paying any attention anymore to what you're saying. And they're going into this fight, flight, freeze mode. So things are really open and exposed up in there. And that's why they're so vulnerable and they're so more likely to take risk, do risky activities at this age, because that prefrontal cortex is not fully developed, and the rest of the brain, it's like, you know, wide open. And what we're seeing right now during this pandemic experience and the closes and lockdowns and the fear that's been out there is that teenagers are highly anxious, but they're also experiencing grief and loss.
Right.
Grief and loss for these important monumental occasions, such as their graduation, grade 9 graduation, their hockey tournaments or things that they've been working for so hard throughout the year that they were not able to do. So, you know, if you think about it, and that we spend 12 years of our adolescents' lives, school lives, gearing them up for this great graduation they're going to have, that's the reward. You're going to walk the stage and wear a gown and have a grad dance or banquet or celebration or whatever it is. And that was just like completely ripped out under the rug, it was ripped out under their feet. And so they have that peace. They've also had a disconnection from peers, which is not normal for an adolescent. Adolescents are wired to be out doing activity with peers. Developmentally, they need that. So that is a problem that's happening for them. They've had a great disconnection. And then there's been more conflict in the home. There's been more arguing with siblings, with parents, more reason for them to start, you know, hating themselves. Because as much as we look at them and think, what is going on with your head when you make these choices that you make, they feel that internally as well. They think, what is wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
What is so wrong with me that I can't do this right? And everybody hates me and everyone's yelling at me and I can't do anything right. And that sort of thing. So they're internalizing a lot of that. And that might come out as behaviors where we see, you know, extreme behaviors in our young people. It might show up as isolating themselves in their rooms, not wanting to talk to anyone or go anywhere. You know, so it might look more like a depressive state. All of that is happening. It has been happening right now for young people. We definitely have seen an increase in OCD, thinking about the pandemic and germs and all of this hand washing that we have to do, and fear of contracting the virus. So there's been an increase in OCD that way. There's also been an increase based on the anxiety that young people are feeling. So the anxiety triggering more obsessive compulsive behaviors as well that aren't necessarily germ related. Social anxiety. So even though, you know, they are wired to be out with friends and peers, we've had them isolated for a long time now. And so there's some anxiety around, how do I act around my peers? How do I manage myself in these social situations again? Which we, you know, many of us parents know that our kids have had difficulty with that over years. If you think about them, like going to a new school or starting a new grade, a new classroom without a friend there, right? They get anxious. They're, how do I make friends again? And the other thing that we've noticed is an increase in eating disorders during this time. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot, there's been so much talk about COVID weight gain and things like that.
Yes.
And it's crossing all of their social media platforms. So they're seeing it, they're absorbing it, they're seeing it, absorbing it. They are in a place of panic and worry and stress and anxiety because of the pandemic and because of all the loss that they've felt. So it really is the perfect storm for eating disorders to start to rise and anxiety disorders to rise. So we are definitely seeing those things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I was thinking about talking with you today, I was thinking about that first episode that you had where you talked about E plus R equals O, the experience and the reaction or the response of the parent will determine what the outcome is. And I was thinking about that with what's happening with our teens right now. And as parents, we are highly anxious right now. We're stressed. We're working from home. We're trying to work from home. If we have a number of people in the house, right? We may have had job losses in the family or layoffs. So we're dealing with a lot less income than we would normally have. We're dealing possibly with elderly parents, with our own, you know, family health or our own health. And so the stresses are high for everybody. And so as parents, if we are having negative experiences with our teens and we are reacting in a way that is further triggering or further engaging their behaviors or something like that, then we could be gearing up for a negative outcome or setting ourselves up and our teen for a negative outcome. But it's so easy to do because a lot of parents have not had to deal with behaviors before with their youth. And yes. So they're not sure how to react to this and what to do. So I really like how you had framed the, you know, let's try and make some decisions beforehand about deciding to respond instead of react. And so I thought, you know, that's a really good piece of information to have, that if we could figure out how we want to respond to these high stress situations with our young people, with our teens right now, then we're less likely to react. And then we may have a better outcome in the end. So I was thinking about how do you do that? And I know that learning is a big piece, but people are stressed. Like I said, there's not a lot of time for learning. So I really like what you're doing with these kind of small bite-sized podcast episodes where somebody can listen to this while they're, you know, making dinner or doing laundry or driving to the grocery store, something like that. Listen to the podcast and have a little bit of a takeaway to take with them today.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome.
Yeah, when you mentioned outcomes, I was thinking again about, you know, choice theory with Dr. Glasser and his needs. And it's just so significant to look at, you know, the needs of all people, but especially our youth. And the needs he lists is relationship, belonging, safety and stability, trust, competence, meaning, and security.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we as parents, you know, offset those needs when all of those needs are being attacked right now?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how do we try to, you know, if those meeting those needs is our outcome that we want, what behaviors would we want to be engaging in with mm-hmm. our kids, right?
Yeah, great question. And just as you read those, they both, it actually, in my mind, I was thinking, wow, that aligns well with the circle of courage and Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
Right. So there's all of those pieces of you need that safety and you need that sense of belonging and relationship. You know, one thing that I find is really important right now is providing a space for teens to be able to express their emotions, whether that be a safe space in conversation with you as a parent, or a journal is a good place for them to write down and express their fears, concerns, anger, grief, whatever it is, to get it out of rumbling around inside their brain and get it out on paper. And hopefully they're willing to share it, because as a parent, if you're able to see what it is they're struggling with, then you can provide space, you can hold space for them to have that safe place to talk about what their concerns are. It helps to regulate them as well, right? When we know what their challenges are, or when they know what their challenges are, because sometimes they don't. They are feeling things and they are feeling a heightened sense of emotion and anxiety or those things, but they don't know the terminology, right? They might not be able to say, I'm feeling anxious, but you can see in their behaviors, right, that something's going on.
Because as you said, the executive functioning isn't really working, which is what's responsible for being able to process and articulate those emotions, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So something that parents can do is provide a place for their teens to be able to regulate those emotions. And one thing that comes out of actually from Dr. Bruce Perry and his work is doing activities that have repetition. So repetition helps to regulate the brain. So if you think about something like going for a walk or dribbling a basketball or painting or coloring even, they're repetitive activities. And so doing that for a period of time helps regulate the brain, regulate the nervous system, bring down blood pressure, help calm the body and calm the mind. Art, dance, yoga, soccer. Another really great one that's an individual sport is skateboarding. Somebody at Hull Services actually has done some research and some presentations on the use of skateboarding as regulating activity. So if you think about it, if somebody's like skateboarding down the sidewalk, for instance, and they're hearing the as the wheels are going and hitting the sidewalks, the grooves in the sidewalk over and over and over, it's just very regulating sounds, right? Drumming is another one. So you're just using a beat and it's the same repetition over and over. And some say that this mimics the heartbeat and that's why it's calming. But regardless, it works. It's calming and it's regulating. So those are some great things to kind of have around the house as ongoing options for regulating teens when they're starting to feel anxious or a little bit out of control. Another really easy way is to create some art and have some things on hand, things that you might even already have at home to be able to help your teen not only regulate and feel a sense of calm, but feel a sense of hope, because they're feeling so hopeless. And it's nice to have a place where they can sit down and look at things or express things that are hopeful. And now that we're starting to get vaccinations out, and in Alberta right now, things are opening up a little bit, and there's a sense of hope. We're into lovely weather, spring and summer months coming up. So there's opportunity to get out and to do things. But if an activity that you might be able to do with a team is to get out some crayons or pencil crayons or any art supplies that you might have, or magazines are great, and create a little hope art piece. It could be in an art journal, or it could just be on a single piece of paper, but find images that represent hope for your young person. Have them find the images. Sit down with them. If you can, do one yourself and just cut out some images that speak to you, or have your young person to do that speak to them about hope and what they're hopeful for. And then glue those onto a piece of paper or a card, or paint or draw your own images of hope. And it gets us into a more positive thinking frame of mind, and can really help us remember that there's hope. We can have hope. Things are getting better. Another good thing to do then is to actually create a statement or a phrase or an affirmation that can go along with this hope art piece. And actually take a minute each day and write out that phrase or that statement. And if you were to do that for 30 days, that actually is going to create a new neural pathway in the brain and allow for that to become the brain's reality, as opposed to fear, dread, isolation, panic, all these things that we've been experiencing and hearing over and over and over. So there's already been a neural pathway that's been created in our brains from the pandemic, from the media, and from all the things that we've had to listen to every day. Well, now we need to work to create our new neural pathway of hope. And that can be done by utilizing an activity such as this.
Yeah, those are fantastic ideas. It made me remember that during my practicum in a whole family treatment program, many of those kinds of ideas were incorporated into the treatment. You know, those expressions and writing down, a theme of hope for the family, where they want to get to, each family member contributing to the piece of artwork.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very powerful.
Yeah, it is. And so the artwork gives you the visual. And then the writing down is what starts to change the neural pathway in the brain. Mm-hmm. And so the writing piece is really important, because that is what actually integrates the what you're doing on the paper with the art, and it integrates it into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So just to pivot as we wind up here, I am wondering, with, you know, COVID trauma in mind, and as a professional in child and youth care, what suggestions could you give to me for topics that you think would be important to discuss with parents of teens in future podcasts?
Mm-hmm. I think that having a podcast maybe around anxiety might be a good idea. I think that, you know, what we know from other events that have happened in the recent past through more natural disaster type episodes or situations that have happened to communities, is that things go back to normal. And I say normal in that, yes, you go back to school and you go back to work and you go back to living and doing the things you need to do, but your amygdala doesn't necessarily go back to normal.
Exactly.
And some remain stuck. And so you may find that teenagers are still living in a heightened state of anxiety for some time after. And so I'm thinking that if you did something around anxiety and recognizing it, it shows up in so many different ways. So recognizing the faces of anxiety, and then something around managing anxiety in the family, in the home, and, you know, helping your teen manage their anxiety. That would probably be quite helpful.
Yeah, it does sound like, a very core foundational issue to address and explore.
And, thinking about that and thinking about opening up as we're talking about starting to get back to more normal activities, I think it is really important that we do normalize for our young people as quickly as we can. And so, depending on what that looks like, on different communities might be in different stages of reopening, but having an outlet for your teen to connect with other teens, with their peers, however you can, whether that be in an online format, outside, the weather's nice now, getting outside, getting them outside, whether it be your backyard or, they're at the neighbor's backyard or out in the open field or something like that, where they can be around their peers. If you're able to put them back into recreational activities, I would recommend absolutely doing that. However, keeping in mind that anxiety and that social anxiety might be higher than normal.
Mm-hmm.
So you might need to prepare beforehand to prepare to respond to that instead of react to that. So if you're, as a parent, you're preparing that my child is going to go back to school, go back to activities, and perhaps they're going to be anxious about that. And then you can prepare for how you're going to react or respond as a parent, not react. And we know our kids, right? We know our kids that are more anxious. Some of us have higher anxiety kids than others. And some kids are just chomping at the bit to get back out to activities. So they're going to be reacting in different ways. And parents are going to be reacting in different ways as well. Right now, some are super excited to get their kids back to normal activities, and some are feeling more fearful. So managing your own response to your own anxieties around that, and these tips that I gave for the art, that works just as well for us adults and for parents. I do it on a regular basis. I know other people that do it as well, and it really helps to keep ourselves in a calmer state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very exhilarating yesterday as I drove around. I saw the sports field. It was filled with sports teams and youth and parents. It was practically a swarm.
Yeah.
But with the sunshine and knowing that patios are opening again,
yeah,
restaurants absolutely. And things like that. Yeah, it was very exciting.
Yeah.